Greek capitulation can change a warrior as much, if not more, than the total control of the dreaming body. In this respect, dreaming and stalking lead to the same end, the entering into the third attention. It is important for a warrior, however, to know and practice both. The key element in recapitulating is breathing. Recollecting is easy if one can reduce the area of stimulation around the body. Theoretically, stalkers have to remember every feeling that they have had in their lives, and this process begins with a breath. Write down a list of the events to be relived. The procedure starts with an initial breath. Stalkers begin with their chin on the right shoulder and slowly inhale as they move their head over a 180-degree arc. The breath terminates on the left shoulder. Once the inhalation ends, the head goes back to a relaxed position. They exhale, looking straight ahead. The stalker then takes the event at the top of the list and remains with it until all the feelings expended in it have been recounted. As stalkers remember the feelings they invested in whatever it is that they are remembering, they inhale slowly, moving their head from the right shoulder to the left. The function of this breathing is to restore energy. The luminous body is constantly creating cobweb-like filaments which are projected out of the luminous mass, propelled by emotions of any sort. Therefore, every situation of interaction or every situation where feelings are involved is potentially draining to the luminous body. By breathing from right to left while remembering a feeling, stalkers, through the magic of breathing, pick up the filaments they left behind. The next immediate breath is from left to right, and it is an exhalation. With it, stalkers eject filaments left in them by other luminous bodies involved in the event being recollected. These are the mandatory preliminaries of stalking. Unless stalkers have gone through the preliminaries in order to retrieve the filaments they have left in the world, and particularly in order to reject those that others have left in them, there is no possibility of handling controlled folly, because those foreign filaments are the basis of one's limitless capacity for self-importance. In order to practice controlled folly, since it is not a way to fool or chastise people or feel superior to them, one has to be capable of laughing at oneself. One of the results of a detailed recapitulation is genuine laughter upon coming face to face with the boring repetition of one's self-esteem, which is at the core of all human interactions. The rule defines stalking and dreaming as arts, therefore they are something that one performs. The life-giving nature of breath is what also gives it its cleansing capacity. It is this capacity that makes a recapitulation into a practical matter. A profound recapitulation is the most expedient means to lose the human form. Thus, it is easier for stalkers, after recapitulating their lives, to make use of all the not-doings of the self, such as erasing personal history, losing self-importance, breaking routines, and so forth. A stalker never pushes himself to the front. In order to apply this seventh principle of the art of stalking, one has to apply the other six. Only a master stalker can be a master of controlled folly. Controlled folly doesn't mean to con people. It means, as my benefactor explained it, that warriors apply the seven basic principles of the art of stalking to whatever they do, from the most trivial acts to life and death situations. Applying these principles brings about three results. The first is that stalkers learn never to take themselves seriously. They learn to laugh at themselves. If they're not afraid of being a fool, they can fool anyone. The second is that stalkers learn to have endless patience. Stalkers are never in a hurry. They never fret. And the third is that stalkers learn to have an endless capacity to improvise. Stalkers face the oncoming time. Normally, we face time as it recedes from us. Only stalkers can change that and face time as it advances on them. They see time as something concrete yet incomprehensible. We're warriors, and warriors have only one thing in mind, their freedom. To die and be consumed by the indescribable force is no challenge. On the other hand, to sneak around the indescribable force and be free is the ultimate audacity. What's needed to enter fully into the other self is to abandon the intent of our first attention. Be frugal and utilize every bit of your energy without wasting any of it. When I talk about time, I am not referring to something which is measured by the movement of a clock. Time is the essence of attention. The indescribable forces, emanations, are made out of time, and properly, when one enters into any aspect of the other self, one is becoming acquainted with time. The wheel of time is like a state of heightened awareness, which is part of the other self, as the left side awareness is part of the self of everyday life. It can physically be described as a tunnel of infinite length and width, a tunnel with reflective furrows. Every furrow is infinite, and there are infinite numbers of them. Living creatures are compulsorily made by the force of life to gaze into one furrow. To gaze into it means to be trapped by it, to live that furrow. Will belongs to the wheel of time. It is something like the runner of a vine, or an intangible tentacle which all of us possess. A warrior's final aim is to learn to focus it on the wheel of time in order to make it turn. Warriors who have succeeded in turning the wheel of time can gaze into any furrow and draw from it whatever they desire. To be trapped compulsorily by one furrow of time entails seeing the images of that furrow only as they recede. To be free from the spellbinding force of those grooves means that one can look in either direction as images recede or as they approach. Warriors have no life of their own. From the moment they understand the nature of awareness, they cease to be persons, and the human condition is no longer part of their view. You have your duty as a warrior, and nothing else is important, so do your best. The challenge of a warrior is to arrive at a very subtle balance of positive and negative forces. This challenge does not mean that a warrior should strive to have everything under control, but that a warrior should strive to meet any conceivable situation, the expected and the unexpected, with equal efficiency. To be perfect under perfect circumstances is to be a paper warrior. I will give you a formula, an incantation, for times when your task is greater than your strength. I am already given to the power that rules my fate, and I cling to nothing, so I will have nothing to defend. I have no thoughts, so I will see. I fear nothing, so I will remember myself. Detached and at ease, I will dart past the eagle to be free. It takes an enormity of strength to let go of the intent of everyday life. One must place one's attention on the luminous shell. A warrior must invoke intent. The glance is the secret. The eyes beckon intent. The reason why seeing seems to be visual is because we need the eyes to focus on intent. Our eyes can catch another aspect of intent, and that's called seeing. The true function of the eyes is to be the catchers of intent. You should trust yourself. On the left side, there are no tears. A warrior can no longer weep. The only expression of anguish is a shiver that comes from the very depths of the universe. It is as if one of the indescribable forces' emanations is anguish. The warrior's shiver is infinite. The act of remembering the other self is thoroughly incomprehensible. In actuality, it is the act of remembering oneself which does not stop at recollecting the interaction warriors perform in their left side awareness, but goes on to recollect every memory that the luminous body has stored from the moment of birth. This act of remembering, although it seems to be only associated with warriors, is something that is within the realm of every human being. Every one of us can go directly to the memories of our luminosity with unfathomable results. There is no completeness without sadness and longing, for without them there is no sobriety, no kindness. Wisdom without kindness and knowledge without sobriety are useless. Seeing is a peculiar feeling of knowing something without a shadow of a doubt. Self-importance is our greatest enemy. Think about it. What weakens us is feeling offended by the deeds and misdeeds of our fellow men. Our self-importance requires that we spend most of our lives offended by someone. Every effort should be made to eradicate self-importance from the lives of warriors. Without self-importance, we are invulnerable. Self-importance can't be fought with niceties. Seers are divided into two categories, Those who are willing to exercise self-restraint and can channel their activities toward pragmatic goals, which would benefit other seers and men in general, and those who don't care about self-restraint or about any pragmatic goals. The latter have failed to resolve the problem of self-importance. Self-importance is not something simple and naive. On the one hand, it is the core of everything that is good in us, and on the other hand, the core of everything that is rotten. To get rid of the self-importance that is rotten requires a masterpiece of strategy. In order to follow the path of knowledge, one has to be very imaginative. In the path of knowledge, nothing is as clear as we'd like it to be. Warriors fight self-importance as a matter of strategy, not principle. Impeccability is nothing else but the proper use of energy. My statements have no inkling of morality. I've saved energy, and that makes me impeccable. To understand this, you have to save enough energy yourself. Warriors take strategic inventories. They list everything they do. Then they decide which of those things can be changed in order to allow themselves a respite in terms of expending their energy. The strategic inventory covers only behavioral patterns that are not essential to our survival and well-being. In the strategic inventories of warriors, self-importance figures as the activity that consumes the greatest amount of energy, hence their effort to eradicate it. One of the first concerns of warriors is to free that energy in order to face the unknown with it. The action of rechanneling that energy is impeccability. The most effective strategy for rechanneling that energy consists of six elements that interplay with one another. Five of them are called the attributes of warriorship: control, discipline, forbearance, timing, and will. They pertain to the world of the warrior who is fighting to lose self-importance. The sixth element, which is perhaps the most important of all, pertains to the outside world and is called the petty tyrant. A petty tyrant is a tormentor, someone who either holds the power of life and death over warriors or simply annoys them to distraction. Petty tyrants teach us detachment. The ingredients of the new seer's strategy shows how efficient and clever is the device of using a petty tyrant. The strategy not only gets rid of self-importance, it also prepares warriors for the final realization that impeccability is the only thing that counts in the path of knowledge. Usually only four attributes are played. The fifth, will, is always saved for an ultimate confrontation when warriors are facing the firing squad, so to speak. Will belongs to another sphere, the unknown. The other four belong to the known, exactly where the petty tyrants are lodged. In fact, what turns human beings into petty tyrants is precisely the obsessive manipulation of the known. The interplay of all the five attributes of warriorship is done only by seers who are also impeccable warriors and have mastery over will. Such an interplay is a supreme maneuver that cannot be performed on the daily human stage. Four attributes are all that is needed to deal with the worst of petty tyrants, provided, of course, that a petty tyrant has been found. The petty tyrant is the outside element, the one we cannot control, and the element that is perhaps the most important of them all. The warrior who stumbles on a petty tyrant is a lucky one. You're fortunate if you come upon one in your path, because if you don't, you have to go out and look for one. If seers can hold their own in facing petty tyrants, they can certainly face the unknown with impunity, and then they can even stand the presence of the unknowable. Nothing can temper the spirit of a warrior as much as the challenge of dealing with impossible people in positions of power. Only under those conditions can warriors acquire the sobriety and serenity to stand the presence of the unknowable. The perfect ingredient for the making of a superb seer is a petty tyrant with unlimited prerogatives. Seers have to go to extremes to find a worthy one. Most of the time, they have to be satisfied with very small fry. Then, warriors develop a strategy using the four attributes of warriorship: control, discipline, forbearance, and timing. On the path of knowledge, there are four steps. The first step is the decision to become apprentices. After the apprentices change their views about themselves and the world, they take the second step and become warriors, which is to say, beings capable of the utmost discipline and control over themselves. The third step, after acquiring forbearance and timing, is to become men of knowledge. When men of knowledge learn to see, they have taken the fourth step and have become seers. Control and discipline refer to an inner state. A warrior is self-oriented, not in a selfish way, but in the sense of a total examination of the self. Forbearance and timing are not quite an inner state. They are in the domain of the man of knowledge. The idea of using a petty tyrant is not only for perfecting the warrior's spirit, but also for enjoyment and happiness. Even the worst tyrant can bring delight, provided, of course, that one is a warrior. The mistake average men make in confronting petty tyrants is not to have a strategy to fall back on. The fatal flaw is that average men take themselves too seriously. Their actions and feelings, as well as those of the petty tyrants, are all important. Warriors, on the other hand, not only have a well-thought-out strategy, but are free from self-importance. What restrains their self-importance is that they have understood that reality is an interpretation we make. Petty tyrants take themselves with deadly seriousness, while warriors do not. What usually exhausts us is the wear and tear on our self-importance. Any man who has an iota of pride is ripped apart by being made to feel worthless. To tune the spirit when someone is trampling on you is called control. Instead of feeling sorry for himself, a warrior immediately goes to work mapping the petty tyrant's strong points, his weaknesses, his quirks of behavior. To gather all this information while they are beating you up is called discipline. A perfect petty tyrant has no redeeming feature. Forbearance is to wait patiently. No rush, no anxiety, a simple, joyful holding back of what is due. A warrior knows he is waiting and what he is waiting for. Right there is the great joy of warriorship. Timing is the quality that governs the release of all that is held back. Control, discipline, and forbearance are like a dam behind which everything is pooled. Timing is the gate in the dam. Forbearance means holding back with the spirit, something that the warrior knows is rightfully due. It doesn't mean that a warrior goes around plotting to do anybody mischief or planning to settle past scores. Forbearance is something independent. As long as the warrior has control, discipline, and timing, forbearance assures giving whatever is due to whoever deserves it. To be defeated by a small fry petty tyrant is not deadly, but devastating. Warriors who succumb to a small fry petty tyrant are obliterated by their own sense of failure and unworthiness. Anyone who joins the petty tyrant is defeated. To act in anger, without control and discipline, to have no forbearance, is to be defeated. After warriors are defeated, they either regroup themselves, or they abandon the quest for knowledge and join the ranks of the petty tyrants for life. There are a series of truths about awareness that have been arranged in a specific sequence for purposes of comprehension. The mastery of awareness consists in internalizing the total sequence of such truths. The first truth is that our familiarity with the world we perceive compels us to believe that we are surrounded by objects, existing by themselves and as themselves, just as we perceive them, whereas in fact, there is no world of objects, but a universe of the indescribable force's emanations. Before I can explain the indescribable force's emanations, I have to talk about the known, the unknown, and the unknowable. The unknown is something that is veiled from man, shrouded perhaps by a terrifying context, but which, nonetheless, is within man's reach. The unknown becomes the known at a given time. The unknowable, on the other hand, is the indescribable, the unthinkable, the unrealizable. It is something that will never be known to us, and yet it is there, dazzling and at the same time horrifying in its vastness. There is a simple rule of thumb. In the face of the unknown, man is adventurous. It is a quality of the unknown to give us a sense of hope and happiness. Man feels robust, exhilarated. Even the apprehension that it arouses is very fulfilling. The new seers saw that man is at his best in the face of the unknown. The unknown and the known are really on the same footing because both are within the reach of human perception. Seers can leave the known at a given moment and enter into the unknown. Whatever is beyond our capacity to perceive is the unknowable, and the distinction between it and the knowable is crucial. Confusing the two would put seers in a most precarious position whenever they are confronted with the unknowable. Most of what's out there is beyond our comprehension. The first truth about awareness is that the world out there is not really as we think it is. We think it is a world of objects, and it's not. You say you agree with me because everything could be reduced to being a field of energy. But you are merely intuiting a truth. To reason it out is not to verify it. I'm not interested in your agreement or disagreement, but in your attempt to comprehend what is involved in this truth. You cannot witness fields of energy, not as an average man, that is. Now, if you were able to see them, you would be a seer, in which case you would be explaining the truths about awareness. Conclusions arrived at through reasoning have very little or no influence in altering the course of our lives. Hence the countless examples of people who have the clearest convictions and yet act diametrically against them time and time again, and have, as the only explanation for their behavior, the idea that to err is human. The first truth is that the world is as it looks, and yet it isn't. It's not as solid and real as our perception has led us to believe, but it isn't a mirage either. The world is not an illusion, as it has been said to be. It's real on the one hand and unreal on the other. Pay close attention to this, for it must be understood, not just accepted. We perceive. That is a hard fact. But what we perceive is not a fact of the same kind, because we have learned what to perceive. Something out there is affecting our senses. This is the part that is real. The unreal part is what our senses tell us is there. Take a mountain, for instance. Our senses tell us that it is an object. It has size, color, form. We even have categories of mountains, and they are downright accurate. Nothing wrong with that. The flaw is simply that it has never occurred to us that our senses play only a superficial role. Our senses perceive the way they do because a specific feature of our awareness forces them to do so. I've used the term the world to mean everything that surrounds us. I have a better term, of course, but it would be quite incomprehensible to you. Seers say that we think there is a world of objects out there only because of our awareness, but what's really out there are the indescribable forces' emanations. Fluid, forever in motion, and yet unchanged, eternal. The reason for the existence of all sentient beings is to enhance awareness. The old seers, risking untold dangers, actually saw the indescribable force which is the source of all sentient beings. They called that indescribable force the eagle, because in the few glimpses that they could sustain, they saw it as something that resembled a black and white eagle of infinite size. They saw that it is the indescribable force that bestows awareness and creates sentient beings so that they will live and enrich the awareness it gives them with life. They also saw that it is the indescribable force that devours that same enriched awareness after making sentient beings relinquish it at the moment of death. For the old seers to say that the reason for existence is to enhance awareness is not a matter of faith or deduction. They saw it. The Nahual man or woman is someone flexible enough to be anything. To be a Nahual, among other things, means to have no points to defend. The description of the indescribable force as the eagle and what it does are not truths to defend passionately. Those truths were put together for the delight and enlightenment of warriors, not to engage any proprietary sentiments. When I told you that a Nahual has no points to defend, I meant, among other things, that a Nahual has no obsessions. The indescribable force is as real for seers as gravity and time are for you, and just as abstract and incomprehensible. The indescribable force and its emanations are as corroboratable as gravity and time, and the discipline of the new seers is dedicated to doing just that. The indescribable force's emanations are an immutable thing in itself, which engulfs everything that exists, the knowable and the unknowable. There is no way to describe in words what the indescribable force's emanations really are. A seer must witness them. They are a presence, almost a mass of sorts, a pressure that creates a dazzling sensation. One can catch only a glimpse of them, as one can catch only a glimpse of the indescribable force itself. There is nothing visual about the indescribable force. The entire body of a seer senses the indescribable force. There is something in all of us that can make us witness with our entire body. Seers explain the act of seeing the indescribable force in very simple terms. Because man is composed of the indescribable force's emanations, man need only revert back to his components. The problem arises with man's awareness. It is his awareness that becomes entangled and confused. At the crucial moment when it should be a simple case of the emanations acknowledging themselves, man's awareness is compelled to interpret. The result is a vision of the eagle and the eagle's emanations. But there is no eagle, and no eagle's emanations. What is out there is something that no living creature can grasp. The characteristic of miserable seers is that they are willing to forget the wonder of the world. They become overwhelmed by the fact that they see, and believe that it's their genius that counts. A seer must be a paragon in order to override the nearly invincible lackness of our human condition. More important than seeing itself is what seers do with what they see. The indescribable force attracts our consciousness, much as a magnet attracts iron shavings. At the moment of dying, all of our being disintegrates under the attraction of that immense force. Seers who see the indescribable force's emanations often call them commands. That's what they really are, commands. Everything is made out of the indescribable force's emanations. Only a small portion of those emanations is within reach of human awareness, and that small portion is still further reduced to a minute fraction by the constraints of our daily lives. That minute fraction of the indescribable force's emanations is the known. The small portion within possible reach of human awareness is the unknown, and the incalculable rest is the unknowable. The new seers, being pragmatically oriented, became immediately cognizant of the compelling power of the emanations. They realized that all living creatures are forced to employ the indescribable force's emanations without ever knowing what they are. They also realized that organisms are constructed to grasp a certain range of those emanations, and that every species has a definite range. The emanations exert great pressure on organisms, and through that pressure, organisms construct their perceivable world. In our case, as human beings, we employ those emanations and interpret them as a reality. But what man senses is such a small portion of the indescribable force's emanations that it's ridiculous to put much stock in our perceptions. And yet, it isn't possible for us to disregard our perceptions. I want you to be very aware of what we are doing. We are discussing the mastery of awareness. The truths we're discussing are the principles of that mastery. One of the greatest forces in the lives of warriors is fear. It spurs them to learn. The indescribable force's emanations cannot be rendered at all in a language of comparisons. Individual seers may feel the urge to make comments about certain emanations, but that will remain personal. The new seers were terribly practical men. They weren't involved in concocting rational theories. The new seers, imbued with practicality, were able to see a flux of emanations and to see how man and other living beings utilize them to construct their perceivable world. The way those emanations are utilized by man is so simple it sounds idiotic. For a seer, men are luminous beings. Our luminosity is made up of that portion of the indescribable force's emanations which is encased in our egg-like cocoon. That particular portion, that handful of emanations that is encased, is what makes us men. To perceive is to match the emanations contained inside our cocoon with those that are outside. Seers can see, for instance, the emanations inside any living creature and can tell which of the outside emanations would match them. The emanations are something indescribable. My personal comment would be to say that they are like filaments of light. What's incomprehensible to normal awareness is that the filaments are aware. I can't tell you what that means because I don't know what I'm saying. All I can tell you with my personal comments is that the filaments are aware of themselves, alive and vibrating, that there are so many of them that numbers have no meaning, and that each of them is an eternity in itself. Perception is a condition of alignment. The emanations inside the cocoon become aligned with those outside that fit them. Alignment is what allows awareness to be cultivated in every living creature. Seers make these statements because they see living creatures as they really are, luminous beings that look like bubbles of whitish light. The emanations inside and the emanations outside are the same filaments of light. Sentient beings are minute bubbles made out of those filaments, microscopic points of light attached to the infinite emanations. The luminosity of living beings is made by the particular portion of the indescribable force's emanations they happen to have inside their luminous cocoons. When seers see perception, they witness that the luminosity of the indescribable force's emanations outside those creatures' cocoons brightens the luminosity of the emanations inside their cocoons. The outside luminosity attracts the inside one. It traps it, so to speak, and fixes it. That fixation is the awareness of every specific being. Seers can also see how the emanations outside the cocoon exert a particular pressure on the portion of emanations inside. This pressure determines the degree of awareness that every living being has. The indescribable forces' emanations are more than filaments of light. Each one of them is a source of boundless energy. Think of it this way. Since some of the emanations outside the cocoon are the same as the emanations inside, their energies are like a continuous pressure. But the cocoon isolates the emanations that are inside its web and thereby directs the pressure. I've mentioned to you that the old seers were masters of the art of handling awareness. What I can add now is that they were the masters of that art because they learned to manipulate the structure of man's cocoon. I've said to you that they unraveled the mystery of being aware. By that, I meant that they saw and realized that awareness is a glow in the cocoon of living beings. They rightly called it the glow of awareness. The old seers saw that man's awareness is a glow of amber luminosity more intense than the rest of the cocoon. That glow is on a narrow, vertical band on the extreme right side of the cocoon, running along its entire length. The mastery of the old seers was to move that glow, to make it spread from its original setting on the surface of the cocoon inward across its width. Seeing is to lay bare the core of everything, to witness the unknown and to glimpse into the unknowable. As such, it doesn't bring one solace. Seers ordinarily go to pieces on finding out that existence is incomprehensibly complex and that our normal awareness maligns it with its limitations. Your concentration has to be total. To understand is of crucial importance. The new seers place the highest value on deep, unemotional realizations. For instance, the other day, when you understood about your self-importance, you didn't understand anything, really. You had an emotional outburst. That was all. I say this because the next day you were back on your high horse of self-importance, as if you had never realized anything. The same thing happened to the old seers. They were given to emotional reactions. But when the time came for them to understand what they had seen, they couldn't do it. To understand, one needs sobriety, not emotionality. Beware of those who weep with realization, for they have realized nothing. There are untold dangers in the path of knowledge for those without sober understanding. I am outlining the order in which the new seers arranged the truths about awareness, so it will serve you as a map that you have to corroborate with your seeing, but not with your eyes. Everybody falls prey to the mistake that seeing is done with the eyes. Seeing is not a matter of the eyes. Seeing is alignment, and perception is alignment. The alignment of the indescribable forces' emanations used routinely is the perception of the day-to-day world. But the alignment of emanations that are never used ordinarily is seeing. When such an alignment occurs, one sees. Seeing, therefore, being produced by alignment out of the ordinary, cannot be something one could merely look at. So don't succumb to the way seeing is labeled and described. When seers see, something explains everything as the new alignment takes place. It's a voice that tells them in their ear what's what. If that voice is not present, what the seer is engaged in isn't seeing. It is equally fallacious to say that seeing is hearing, because it is infinitely more than that. But seers have opted for using sound as a gauge of a new alignment. The voice of seeing is a most mysterious, inexplicable thing. My personal conclusion is that the voice of seeing belongs only to man. It may happen because talking is something that no one else besides man does. The old seers believed it was the voice of an overpowering entity intimately related to mankind, a protector of man. The new seers found out that that entity, which they called the mold of man, doesn't have a voice. The voice of seeing for the new seers is something quite incomprehensible. They say it's the glow of awareness playing on the indescribable force's emanations, as a harpist plays on a harp. The pressure that the emanations outside the cocoon, which are called emanations at large, exert on the emanations inside the cocoon is the same in all sentient beings. Yet the results of that pressure are vastly different among them because their cocoons react to that pressure in every conceivable way. There are, however, degrees of uniformity within certain boundaries. Now, when seers see that the pressure of the emanations at large bear down on the emanations inside, which are always in motion, and makes them stop moving, they know that the luminous being at that moment is fixated by awareness. To say that the emanations at large bear down on those inside the cocoon and make them stop moving means that seers see something indescribable, the meaning of which they know without a shadow of a doubt. It means that the voice of seeing has told them that the emanations inside the cocoon are completely at rest and match some of those which are outside. Seers maintain, naturally, that awareness always comes from outside ourselves, that the real mystery is not inside us. Since by nature the emanations at large are made to fixate what is inside the cocoon, the trick of awareness is to let the fixating emanations merge with what is inside us. Seers believe that if we let that happen, we become what we really are, fluid, forever in motion, eternal. The degree of awareness of every individual sentient being depends on the degree to which it is capable of letting the pressure of the emanations at large carry it. Seers have seen that from the moment of conception, awareness is enhanced, enriched, by the process of being alive. The awareness of an individual insect or that of an individual man grows from the moment of conception in astoundingly different ways, but with equal consistency. Awareness develops from the moment of conception. Warriors know that the only real energy we possess is a life-bestowing sexual energy. This knowledge makes them permanently conscious of their responsibility. If warriors want to have enough energy to see, they must become misers with their sexual energy. Nothing can be done to give people a more balanced understanding of the glow of awareness. At least there is nothing that seers can do. Seers aim to be free, to be unbiased witnesses, incapable of passing judgment. Otherwise, they would have to assume the responsibility for bringing about a more adjusted cycle. No one can do that. The new cycle, if it is to come, must come of itself. The consciousness of adult human beings, matured by the process of growth, can no longer be called awareness, because it has become modified into something more intense and complex, which seers call attention. At a given time in the growth of human beings, a band of the emanations inside their cocoons becomes very bright. As human beings accumulate experience, it begins to glow. In some instances, the glow of this band of emanations increases so dramatically that it fuses with the emanations from the outside. Seers witnessing an enhancement of this kind had to surmise that awareness is the raw material and attention the end product of maturation. Attention is the harnessing and enhancing of awareness through the process of being alive. The danger of definitions is that they simplify matters to make them understandable. In this case, in defining attention, one runs the risk of transforming a magical, miraculous accomplishment into something commonplace. Attention is man's greatest single accomplishment. It develops from raw animal awareness until it covers the entire gamut of human alternatives. seers perfect it even further until it covers the whole scope of human possibilities. Human alternatives are everything we are capable of choosing as persons. They have to do with the level of our day-to-day range, the known, and owing to that fact, they are quite limited in number and scope. Human possibilities belong to the unknown. They are not what we are capable of choosing, but what we are capable of attaining. An example of human alternatives is our choice to believe that the human body is an object among objects. An example of human possibilities is the seer's achievement in viewing man as an egg-like luminous being. With the body as an object, one tackles the known. With the body as a luminous egg, one tackles the unknown. Human possibilities have, therefore, nearly an inexhaustible scope. Seers say that there are three types of attention. When they say that, they mean it just for human beings, not for all the satient beings in existence. But the three are not just types of attention. They are, rather, three levels of attainment. They are the first, second, and third attention, each of them an independent domain, complete in itself. The first attention in man is animal awareness, which has been developed through the process of experience into a complex, intricate, and extremely fragile faculty that takes care of the day-to-day world in all its innumerable aspects. In other words, everything that one can think about is part of the first attention.